Welcome to Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, April 9th. As we move into our last week and so of the public hearing section on Senate bills for this session, I'm going to open up public hearing on Senate Bill 269. Mr. Stembridge.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 269 establishes procedures for utility relocation on public highways. You have three amendments that are active, I believe, the dash 2, the dash 3, the dash 4. The dash 2 includes non-utility communications providers. The dash 3 and the dash 4 are similar in some ways and quite different in other ways. Let the proponents of those amendments describe them.
Okay. I'm going to ask the proponent of the bill, Jenny Lang from Quest, to come forward and present the bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jenny Lang. I'm the Director of Governmental Relations for Quest. I'm here to testify today in support of the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 269 regarding the relocation of utility facilities. The amendments, the Dash 4 amendments, represent hours of discussion and significant negotiation and work by a work group that included utilities, Public Utility Commission, ODOT, the League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and a variety of individual counties and cities and others as well. Though there is still some work to be done, I appreciate their efforts to come up with some workable solutions. I also appreciate your indulgence in giving us time to work through some of these issues. We believe that we work well with most jurisdictions in the state and have for many, many years, but we also think that there are ways that we could be more effective about this. So the purpose of Senate Bill 269 is to provide a more structured approach to notifying, planning, and executing utility facility relocation projects throughout the state, regardless of whether the lead public body is the state, a county or city, or some group of public bodies. We would also like to see a clearer understanding of the financial responsibility and obligation to pay for relocation projects for the three primary parties involved: the utility, the government entity, and the developer. Finally, we'd like to provide some kind of a process under the purview of the Oregon Public Utility Commission for utilities to recover unreimbursed costs of relocation projects through a line item on the customer bill. Let me give you just a quick overview of what drives relocation and what it is. Utility relocation is largely driven by private development, including residential subdivisions, commercial or business projects, and industrial development as well. All of these generally require some kind of improved or changed transportation access. It's also driven by public improvement projects, not unlike the recent work on the bus mall in Portland and the attendant work on the light rail project. And despite the current economic slowdown, we think that this is a critical issue right now because of the increased infrastructure activity that we're anticipating because of the federal stimulus package and hopefully a state transportation package as well. While relocation work varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and sometimes even project to project, at some point along the way, the public body involved in orders the utility, and that could be telecom, gas, or electric, to move facilities under its franchise or right-of-way management authority. We do that. Facilities might include poles and wires that you see above ground along the streets. It could include pipelines, cable vaults, and the miles and miles of copper or fiber optic cable that are underground. The utility then tries to recover costs from either the public body, if funding is available for that purpose, or from the developer, but in practice, we often end up absorbing those costs. We're not intending or trying to undercut the home rule or any other authority of a public body, nor get in the way of private developers. For utilities, the only way that we thrive in a state is if there are new and larger and expanded opportunities for customers. So development is really our lifeline as well. We are an integral part of the project team, along with the public body, and in many cases at least one or more private developer, but our role is different from either of theirs. We don't submit a bid on these jobs, nor do we choose whether or not to participate in them. We're directed to do so by a government entity. So what we're trying to do in Senate Bill 269 is enhance existing ways of working together, put in place some processes that might clarify the obligations of all the parties, and provide a way to recoup costs that aren't reimbursed in some other manner. So to the -4 amendments. As you can see, they are considerably different from the printed bill. The first two paragraphs are brief reasons why working together to coordinate our work, reduce cost, and limit disruption for customers and others is in everyone's interest. Section 2(1) are the key definitions used in the bill for highway, public body, and utility. Section 2(2) says that if a public body seeks to have a utility relocate its facilities, it must notify the potentially affected utilities of the project as soon as practicable. Section 2(3) outlines the topics to be discussed during the planning and design phase of the project, including scope and schedule, description of plans, goals and objectives of the proposed project, and options to minimize or eliminate costs for either party. It also makes clear that the public body is not required to avoid or minimize cost that would materially affect the scope, costs, or schedule of the project, and that even if utilities don't show up during this phase of the project, the public body goes ahead with the design and construction. Section 2(4) confirms that existing franchises, permits, or contracts between a public body and a utility are not preempted. You might have noted in the -3 amendment from the League of Oregon Cities that they recommend deleting this section, which is agreeable to the utilities that I'm representing today. Section 2(5) says that the bill doesn't affect utilities' existing rights to receive reimbursement from private parties for relocations in private streets. We spent a considerable amount of time with representatives from ODOT because of the phrase private rights of way and the fact that that had some impact on both state rules and regulations and federal regulations that ODOT operates under. So we came up with some redrafted languages, which is what you have in front of you, and you might again have noticed in the -3 amendments from the League of Oregon Cities that this may not be amenable to them. We are agreeable to dropping sub-5 and have sought and received agreement on that from ODOT, and I'm not sure where the league is on this, but they may have an answer by the time they're here in front of you. Section 2(6) makes it clear that a public body can't prohibit a utility from seeking reimbursement from private parties or customers for relocations by way of language that they might put in a permit application, a license application, or some other written agreement. Section 2(7) is one of the thornier issues that we've run into, and this is the whole area of trying to determine what portion of a project is assignable to the private developer, how much of it to the public entity, and how much that the utility should be expected to absorb in the way of costs. We've spent, again, considerable time trying to sort through this. It's clear that nearly every public body does has a slightly different approach to this, and deciding who has responsible for which portions of the cost is not an easy task. It's a place where we frequently feel like we're the sort of odd man out on this team that works on these projects, because we aren't privy to many of the discussions and decisions between the public body and the developer on exactly how a project is going to play out. So we are continuing to discuss this with Mr. Chamberlain from the Home Builders Association and others, but we believe that this is a very critical element of the bill for us. Section 2 sub 8 outlines a cost recovery mechanism for relocation expenses that aren't reimbursed in some other way from either a developer or the public body that we might identify as a line item on our customer bills through some procedure that we would work out with the Public Utility Commission. This is the second large area where we're still in discussions with PUC staff and have come up with a couple of options that might work for both them and for us. And we would ask for a little additional time to work on both sub 7 and sub 8. So my intention would be to see if we can resolve the remaining issues that we have in very short order and be back to you with a comprehensive set of amendments on Senate Bill 269, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Lang, and I do appreciate all the work you've been working on this and keeping me up to date on what changes and things we're having. I know the real issue is to make sure that we have people at the table throughout this planning process and assess everybody's responsibility and trying to do that before the fact rather than create issues after the fact. And so I think that's a good goal. Questions from the committee at this point for Ms. Lang? I'm sure we will later, but thanks you for giving us the introduction. I'll be going a little bit out of order here on this to accommodate some issues. I think the next person I'm going to call up is the Oregon Public Utility Commission, Brian, and then I'm going to go to Commissioner Leonard, and then we'll go back through our list of folks. Because you're intimately involved in this issue, so I kind of get the PUC, we'll have a little better overview, and then go to some of the other parties.
All right. Sure.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Conway. I'm the administrator of the Telecommunications Division of the Public Utility Commission of Oregon. As you heard earlier with Ms. Lang, we have been working with them on some amendments and principally around the cost recovery mechanism. We have some initial concerns, but we haven't taken a position on the bill. One of the initial concerns would be many of the utilities already have part of their rates are based on the fact that we expect that they will have relocations, and so to the extent there would be another recovery mechanism, we'd like to make sure there wouldn't be double recovery of those costs. And secondly, we also have other mechanisms for kind of outside of general rate making, and we want to make sure those are meshed up well as well. So with that, we're working with as many people as we can on amendments, and we can try to get back to you as quickly as possible.
And where, Mr. Conway, where would you say, from your perspective, and just trying to figure out the mechanics of this for the OPUC, in terms of how close do you think you are to finding a workable mechanism on this?
Well, our conversations of late have revolved around an approach that would be very permissive for the commission. And in that case, it would allow them to go back in and more on a case-by-case basis, maybe with some general rules, look at the projects and try to determine for each utility, was this extraordinary? Was it beyond what's included in rates? And something along that line seems to be pretty promising.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your work on that, too. Any questions for the Public Utility Commission? Yes, Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're saying that there's a presumption that's built into the rates that there would be some relocation. So on the cost recovery discussions, what are the criteria there that would go beyond the rate structure that you have today?
Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, what I'm referring to that is that there is, for many of these utilities, there is a projected level of relocation costs. Mm-hmm. Some of these utilities haven't been in for rate cases for many years, and it probably was not anticipated that there would be a stimulus package like we're seeing today, which is probably going to lead to a lot more relocations than their past. So there could be quite a bit more than was assumed in rates, and it may be reasonable for some type of an outboard adjustment to make sure they get recovery of those costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I just had one final question. A number of years ago, there was an agreement that was created by this legislature that allowed some companies, Quest was one of them, to move out of rate of return regulation in exchange for other things. Does that play at all in terms of how this might be presented for cost recovery? Does that is that a different approach than, say, maybe some other utilities?
That could be one of the issues that we work through. And again, a permissive approach would allow us to take that issue up at a future date. By being removed from a rate of return company, we're no longer looking at their costs and building up from their costs to set a rate. They're pricing based on more market prices.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Right. Thank you. We'll continue to work on that. Commissioner Leonard. You don't know how appropriate it is that this timing is just perfect for you to be here today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
These are your bodyguards, right?
Very much so.
I hear you need them now.
They're actually supposed to be pointed that way. Chair Metzger and members of the committee, my name is Randy Leonard. I'm a member of the Portland City Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 269. The City of Portland acknowledges that minimizing costs of relocating utilities required by public works projects is, in fact, a worthy goal. However, the City currently makes every effort to work with the utilities to keep relocation costs low. For that reason, the bill seems to be a solution in search of a problem. As drafted, Senate Bill 269 is a significant attack on local authority. The bill would unsettle existing law, impose a greater burden on ratepayers, and undermine the authority of municipalities to control their right-of-ways. I understand there are proposals to amend the language in the bill, and many of these proposals would potentially improve some aspects of the bill. I appreciate that the city has been invited by the proponents of the bill to be part of these discussions. Proponents suggest that the bill is needed to ensure early involvement in the planning of projects that will require relocation. Yet the City of Portland already involves utilities in the early stages of project planning. Unfortunately, the utilities often do not appear at those meetings. The legislation, therefore, seems aimed at the wrong problem. At least in the City of Portland, if there is a problem with early collaboration on projects, it is not because the utilities are left out of the room. Moreover, by allowing the utilities to recover all relocation costs, Senate Bill 269 removes existing incentives for utilities to control these costs or to participate in early planning processes. The bill is likely to lead to costly litigation as it unsettles existing law. The bill requires the public to absorb the cost of utility relocates if the city does not involve the utilities in a preliminary design meeting. This not only puts a tremendous potential cost on the public, but creates a set of requirements that will lead to disputes and litigation about the adequacy of notice, the nature of what meets the criteria for an adequate meeting, and related matters. This requirement disturbs law and has been settled for decades. Taxpayers would be subject to a greater burden if the bill passes. The bill shifts the burden of utility surprises found during the course of construction to the public. Thus, when unforeseen difficulties emerge mid-project, the bill makes public entities liable for privately owned utility costs if adequate notice is not provided. Additionally, the bill requires the public to pay for relocations imposed on a private development as a result of approval conditions. This inappropriately shifts costs from a project to the general public. Finally, the bill requires municipalities and other public entities to create new and very specific internal processes at a time when resources are in very short supply. This bill threatens traditional right-of-way authority, Presently, utility relocation costs are only one factor among many that a public entity must consider. Indeed, to protect the public interest, other factors must be considered. By allowing privately owned utility costs to trump other project considerations, the bill makes it difficult for managers of public projects to protect the public in its right-of-way decisions. For all these reasons, the city does oppose Senate Bill 269. As I mentioned, the city has been involved in discussions with sponsors of the bill over the last several weeks. The League of Oregon Cities has separately prepared proposed amendments for this legislation. The City of Portland hopes that the committee will give due consideration to the League's proposal as it helps to address our concerns within the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I know that some of the issues you mentioned in your testimony are some of the things that I've been working on in those Dash 4 amendments, and I realize they're fresh,
right,
and it's a moving target, and you haven't had a chance to totally analyze all those. What I would ask, though, and I appreciate your comments, is with your staff and as to stay in touch with that process,
okay,
to give us a reaction to the current Dash 4 so that we can continue to refine this issue to address the very legitimate issues you brought up, and I know that Ms. Lang and others are trying to work through also, so we have a product that meets the need of all of those who participate in this process, and I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. If I could add one thing.
Yes.
There was some discussion by the prior witness regarding discussions going on between the PUC and the utilities, and we would appreciate if the city could be a part of those discussions as well.
Okay.
And Martha Pellegrino is our point person down here on this.
Okay, and Mr. Conway is in the room, so he heard that, so he's nodding affirmatively, so we'll make sure that those parties are together with
Thank
that,
you.
And we have an opportunity for that. Questions on this issue, first of all, for the commissioner?
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
More of a comment. I got to say, the commissioner and I used to do a radio show together, when he was a senator and I had to testify, the drilling that I got by the commissioner when he was a senator, and I had just been waiting, and now I'm just almost tongue-tied.
I just want to say,
I have no idea what to ask you.
I wake up at night wondering why I wronged you so back then. And I was only hoping you would be a better person than I was.
Well, Commissioner, I guess it's great seeing you down
here.
Nice
to see you, Larry.
Yeah.
It's great.
Any other questions on this issue? Okay, well, before I dismiss you, I have read in the paper that you are just an expert on billboards. And
do you have something you'd like?
Yes. Actually, this is on a serious note, Commissioner, but and it just ties in very roughly with our agenda here of relocation.
Yes.
And we had a very interesting discussion last time. Actually, I'm going to ask Senator Starr. In all seriousness, we're actually going to ask you for your help with your expertise on both relocation and billboards. Senator Starr, you
just condemn it.
Yeah.
My advice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that segue. And thank you, Mr. Commissioner, for being here. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you.
The issue that was before us is a Senate bill relating to billboards, generally statewide regulation and billboards. In the course of that hearing, we had testimony from particular landowners, property owners in the city of Portland. And the situation that they brought to us was one that kind of was tangential to the overall billboard bill, but one that perhaps you could help provide some expertise and maybe some insight on. The situation is where you have a billboard that is located in the city of Portland that is basically grandfathered in, the location is grandfathered in under city ordinance, I believe. And so the property owner in their negotiation with the billboard company, the property owner is in a very difficult negotiating position because the billboard company basically says, well, here's the price.
Right.
And if you don't like the price, you know, too bad, because we can take our billboard down and we have these credits and we can go put a billboard somewhere else. And it puts the property owner in a very, very difficult position in negotiation with the billboard company. It seems to be the kind of that unfair relationship between the property owner and the billboard company as it relates to the city ordinances. We'd like to find a way, at least this particular senator would like to find a way wherein that property owner doesn't sit in such a disadvantage in the negotiation process. And so with that kind of background, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on if there's a way that we could get without statutorily, you know, creating some sort of mandate or something, that there's a way that we could get to a solution in that. And it seems to be Portland-centric or specific.
I'm not surprised. When I first arrived at council after leaving the legislature, one of the very first things I took up was sitting down with Lynn Bergstein, who at that point represented Accolade Communications, and Clear Channel, the subsequent order to Accolade. And we negotiated a package, Lynn and I did, over a period of probably 3 or 4 months that included addressing the issues you're talking about. At that time, if you recall, the mayor of Portland at that time was vehemently opposed to advertising, to billboards, to neon signs. And it's been reported widely, so I don't mind sharing with you her reaction when I was getting ready to bring this settlement ordinance as a result of the negotiations Lynn and I had. She invited me across the street to have a beer one night after council, and only the way Vera could, said, Randy, I just want you to know that this bill you're bringing before council, I'm going to use every tool at my disposal to kill. And I said, okay, Mayor, what would you like to talk about next? And she said, I want to settle this. I said, oh, we have settled it. I'm not going to stake my career on billboards, and I want to assure you that I don't intend to take you on, at least on that issue. And she didn't say, well, I don't want you to feel like I threatened you. She said, I'm glad we understand each other. And so that was a teaching from the master. And, of course, we now have a different climate. We have a mayor who is open to finding some middle ground, because I don't know if you know this, or I imagine you do, but it actually impacts the community in Portland, which is quite liberal and quite artistic, that likes to do community murals. The same issue. It falls under the first or the free speech provisions of the Oregon Constitution. As you know, in our state, we have the most liberal freedom of speech. In fact, when I was a member of the Senate in 1995, I was the only Democrat to vote to refer to the voters an amendment to the free speech provision of the state constitution, allowing the state to regulate adult bookstores, and it was rejected by nearly 80% of the voters. So it's very clear that existing law being what it is, which is you cannot regulate the content within the borders of a billboard or a sign, also includes murals, is just the way that we have to work through this issue. So if we allow murals or we allow a billboard, you have to allow advertising without any regulation on the content. It's an area I've spent more time in than I ever would have thought, and I'd be happy to work with you to find a solution. I think Lynn would tell you that we found a really acceptable middle ground for billboard owners, billboard companies, and the city, and the muralists in that approach, and I've always been disappointed we couldn't bring it forward and adopt. I think it would have satisfied and addressed the issues you're concerned about.
Thank
and
you.
I'm happy to work on it again.
Okay.
Thank you, Christian. We would appreciate that. It's and maybe some of your staff could get back to us, because we're working this bill now. And as you know, the only thing we could do is the big hammer and just say, forget those ordinances.
You want to use big hammers as a last resort.
But we're not interested in doing that. But what we are interested in doing is that it's one of those, as Senator Starr put out, since these things were erected and they're all legal, the ordinance has changed, you know, said, okay, but if they come down, they can't be back. And so it has created a one-sided thing for some large companies who operate in Portland to basically hold hostage. Someone says, if you get it back, no one else can put one here because they changed it.
Yeah.
And it just is, we think that's very unfair. But I said, well, maybe from a city level, you might be able to balance that playing field a little bit so no one uses your ordinances as an economic, you know, extortion item. And I would appreciate you looking into that.
Gotcha. Happy to.
Thank you for your testimony on this bill, and we'll be sure that you're included with the PUC.
Thank you very much. Good seeing you all.
And thank you, colleagues, for letting us modify relocation discussions. Brandon McCarthy from PGE, please. Brendan McCarthy, excuse me, I know that.
That's a cross I bear all the time.
Yeah,
no problem.
Yeah. Well, I know better, so.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Brendan McCarthy, representing PGE. Just wanted to make a couple of quick comments, and you can ask me questions afterwards, obviously. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to make some comments on this bill, and generally speaking, we're supportive of the Dash 4s. We understand that they are undergoing some changes, especially relating to the cost recovery language, and we look forward to being a part of that and seeing that move forward. Generally speaking, we have seen, especially in recent history, a number of cases where PGE has been asked to relocate our facilities essentially for private development, where the private developer has an issue. They ask us to move. We say, well, you have to pay for it. A private developer turns to the city and says, well, you know, it's in a large extent, this is a more of a public issue, and then the city asks us to move, and that's a cost that we bear. We do include in our rate cases a portion for recovery of those amounts. We regularly go beyond that amount, however, so we are bearing that, and our ratepayers are bearing that additional cost. So I think some clarity on this issue is good. Trying to figure out when and where something is private development or public development, I think, is a good thing for this committee to pass judgment on. I think the planning pieces in the bill are good, bringing the utilities in and ensuring that we're there in the planning process so that at some point in time when there is some private development there, we can make that line. We can see that line. And I think that's about it. So, let me hear the questions.
Thank you, Ms. McCarthy. Senator Berger.
Yes, would you explain why you don't know how to distinguish between public and private development?
Chair Metzger and Senator Berger, I think that I'm not going to say that I'm an expert on this, and perhaps that's a good question also for the cities to be involved in answering. My understanding is that sometimes there will be a private development, but in a larger on a plan that the city has, for example, there's something that matches up there where the relocation fits in with essentially a public purpose. So it can be difficult to distinguish. You know, if it's the private development, that's actually sort of what's the nexus for causing the actual relocation to happen. And I understand from my technical side of folks that sometimes appears to us to be a private nexus, but to the city would appear to be a public nexus.
Follow-up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. Is it a matter of just wordsmithing? Because it's not very hard for me to figure out private and a public development, unless you're trying to determine in some advantage or disadvantage to you as to how the label is placed.
Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, as I see the Dash 4s, I think that it's a little bit more than wordsmithing, and I think what they're doing, and I think especially in subsection 2 of section 2 and subsection 3, where there is more of a opportunity for the utilities to be involved in that planning stage, so that all the parties sort of know what their respective responsibilities are and what they're going to be. I think it's a little bit more than wordsmithing. I think it is this bill does give us some ability to understand where the lines are.
Any other questions for Mr. McCarthy? Thank you.
Thanks.
John Chandler and Art Schleck and John DiLorenzo. I just wanted to get these three people together in one picture.
The odd couple?
Usually I'm considered the before picture, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chandler, I'll start with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler here, mumbling on Senate Bill 269. I signed up on the sheet as neutral with a slight arrow towards opposition. The bill is drafted. We would oppose. We have been involved in the discussions with the proponents and with the local governments. This is an important issue. What happens to utility relocation is oftentimes, we're in litigation, builders and developers are occasionally with utilities and with cities about this. It needs to be addressed. Our concern is the bill in front of you, the Dash 4 in particular, don't quite get us there. In our world, from the home builder development side of things, generally speaking, in broad strokes, if it's a project that we're doing and it requires the movement of a utility facility, be it a vault or a pole or what have you, we end up paying for it. If it's our idea, we'll pay for it, that's fine. If it's not our idea, if the city wants it moved because it's in the right-of-way or they have another idea, oftentimes we'll pay for it through SDC credits, system development charge credits, where we'll plug the projects in the right-of-ways on part of the capital improvement plan for the transportation system. We can get some money back. In those circumstances, we end up paying for it. The final kind of broad category is where the city or the county thinks it's a good idea. It's in the right-of-way. It's in our project. But it has nothing to do with our ability to do our project. We'd sooner not pay. Thank you anyway. Oftentimes we end up paying because it's easier to do that than to put up with the litigation or to slow the project down. But we end up in the middle of these discussions, just like the utilities do, just like the local governments do. What we would like in the bill in front of you is either to be out of the conversation altogether this session and go forward and talk about allocating costs and how to work nicely together into the future during the interim, because it does need to happen. Or we'd like to have that process put into this legislation so that we expand the pre-application process at the local level so that you have a conversation with the developer, the city, the county, the ODOT, the utilities, whoever is involved in the process, around one table to talk about who's doing what piece of what thing and what sequence and who's paying for it. The way the Dash 4s are drafted, the process piece only applies to public projects, but there's still a provision in Section 7 where we end up getting to pay if it's a private project. We'd rather not pay if we're not part of that process discussion. If we don't want to be part of the process discussion and not pay, that's fine. We're out of the bill. We understand the issue. We've committed to the utilities to continue working with them, either this session, if it's the committee's desire to do so, or during the interim, on how to get that process piece fixed. But the process piece has to involve the local governments and the developer and the utilities for it to be fair to all of us, and so we all know what the rules are. Alternatively, if the desire of the committee and the utilities and the local governments is to fix the public process, or the public project piece of it, then we would respectfully ask to be allowed to go put our papers elsewhere and be out of the bill. Hence the mumble, hence the arrow slightly leaning. Be glad to take any questions from the committee.
Okay, we'll finish the panel and then we'll see. Mr. Slack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And let me start out by saying we believe that it's appropriate for utilities to be located in the public right-of-way. It's a good place for them, and it's a place where they can be and feel secure that their utilities are going to be there and they're going to be safe, and they're not going to be on private land and impacted by private development and what goes on. We also support improved communication and coordination. And I will want to mention to you that there is a lot of communication and coordination that go on today in terms of, and I'm speaking basically for counties, but I would say just generally for local government, with the utilities. As we look at those utilities being within the public right-of-way and also improvements that would require, in some instances, relocations. We are very concerned of efforts to, if you will, shine a bright light on whose responsibility it is to pay for what, whether it be the private sector, the public sector, or the utilities, because we don't believe that one size fits all. In terms of, you know, the responsibility, and we have lots of different projects that we look at from time to time, and sometimes it's hard to say, is this public or is this private? Because in the case, let's say, of an existing right-of-way that is slated to be widened at some point in the future, and a developer comes in with an application, let's say, for a commercial type of development, a little small shopping center, the local government will ask the developer to improve the right-of-way. And instead of having a 70-foot right-of-way and improvement, we want an 80-foot because we're going to a major collector at this point. Now, is that because the public has asked, because we need the street widened, or is that the request of the private developer, and should they bear because we're asking them to make that improvement at this point that is consistent with the public's overall transportation plan? While we very much support communication and coordination and believe a lot of it goes on today. We understand that there can be improvements, and we are supportive of the Dash 3 amendments that have been prepared at this point, which primarily deal with the question of communication and coordination. And we would urge utilities to be involved in pre-application conferences, and we'd be happy to ask our members to extend invitations to utilities to attend pre-application conferences. That being said, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, counties also believe that utilities should share in the cost of local government's efforts to coordinate with utilities and their use within the public right-of-way. The relocation costs and impacts, affect such things as public safety and the ability to have that road continue to function. Counties are expending considerable amounts of road dollars currently to coordinate with utilities and their continued use of county right-of-ways at this point. And I just want to mention that to you that, you know, when we talk about who's paying what, those are transportation dollars that we're using to coordinate to make sure that the work is done in an effective safety manner at this point. And those are dollars that could be used make sure that those roads are preserved and maintained as they're intended. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you, Mr. Stapp. We'll go to Mr. DiLorenzo.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner at the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I am here on behalf of my clients Integra Telecom, XO Communications, and TW Telecom, which is formerly Time Warner Telecom. My clients are facilities-based competitive local exchange carriers, or CLECs. CLECs are companies that provide competitive telecommunications services primarily to businesses. In providing telecommunications services to our customers, these companies place facilities in the highway right-of-way. The facilities are really no different than the telecommunications facilities that are placed in the highway right-of-way by the incumbent exchange carriers or the ILECs, such as Quest, Verizon, and other smaller local exchange carriers. The ILECs are the progenies of the old Bell system and historic phone companies that were around prior to reorganization. The CLECs support the overarching goal of what Senate Bill 269 appears to do, namely to ensure cooperation when highway projects may require relocation of utility facilities in the right-of-way. The definition of utility, however, in the bill is overly restricted because it would exclude CLECs, thereby jeopardizing the effectiveness of the legislation as a means to ensure cooperation between the public bodies and the providers. A very simple way to correct the apparent oversight would be to amend Section 21C of the printed bill to provide that a utility means not only a public utility or a telecommunications utility, but also a competitive telecommunications provider, because that is a term of art defined in the statute. With that amendment, the bill would ensure that public bodies would also coordinate with CLECs as well as ILECs. And I think the amendment that is now printed in the Dash 2 versions would accomplish this purpose. With respect to the discussion on Section 2.9, the regulated rate-making treatment for relocation costs, we understand Quest and the PUC are working with the stakeholders on this. We're actively monitoring those discussions, but CLEC rates are generally not subject to rate regulation because we are competitive providers. We don't have captive customer bases. So we are watching that. The Dash 4 amendments are fine with us. We merely want parity and would like to be treated the same way as the ILECs are treated. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it, and I'm available to answer any questions if the panel
has
any.
Questions for any of our three panelists? And I know Mr. Chandler and Mr. Slack, you've been working with the group with Ms. Lang, so we'll continue that.
That's correct.
And then I don't know, Mr. DiLorenzo, if you've had communications with Ms. Lang, but he's obviously in the back of the room and nodding, so we'll see if we can work through those issues. Thank you very much. Our last panel is Andrea Fogue and two guests that I can't quite read, so. And one thing I would ask, and I know it's difficult because things are a moving target, but I know you've been a part of this process, so you're more up to speed than some other folks, is as much as possible to keep your comments and thoughts to the current work product, which is your threes and the fours, as opposed to...
Right, and we are prepared, Mr. Chair, to address in a preliminary way the dash fours and the dash twos as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Andrea Fogue with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. This is a very important bill for cities. The League opposes the bill as drafted. There has been a lot of work done on this bill, but as drafted, it's a significant attack on rights of way and franchising authority. So we really appreciate the invitation from Jenny Lang to work with the utilities and work with other folks on this bill. And we do think it has come a long way. Cities currently really address relocation issues through our franchise agreements, through our rights-of-way authority. We're very comfortable doing that. But the piece of this bill that we support is that coordination and cooperation as early as possible in a project between the utilities and cities. And what you'll hear today is that should be two-way cooperation, and often today it is not. So we see a great benefit in putting process in place that will make sure that both the utilities and local governments are coming to the table again as early as possible so that these projects can minimize the costs and minimize the burden on taxpayers. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the Dash 4 and the Dash 2 amendments, but first I want to let you know that those Dash 3 amendments that have been offered, the League requested those amendments because, again, we think we have come a long way to set out a process for coordinating early in the project, and that's exactly what the Dash 3 amendments do. The Dash 3 amendments do not speak at all to developers and the cost that developers pay, and they don't speak to a cost recovery mechanism for the utilities. We think that both pieces of that portion of the bill need a lot more work. There's a long way to go in that process, and so at this point it's very unclear the direction we would go at this point in time. So that's why you see the Dash 3s specific to, again, that early coordination process. And with that, today I have with me Lynn Goodwin with the City of Springfield and Michael Nitschke with the City of Nehalem. And they're going to give you some local perspective on how the relocation works in cities. And we'll start with Lynn, and he's going to address, Mr. Chair, the Dash 2 and the Dash 4 amendments as well.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Goodwin. I'm the Assistant Public Works Director for the City of Springfield. Part of my responsibilities including our franchise management, right-of-way management, as well as general management of the department. I've prepared some fairly extensive testimony, which in the interest of the Chair's direction, I will try to abbreviate as much as possible and focus more on the Dash 4s. But as Andrea mentioned to you, I think it's important you have a good understanding of what the actual process is for a small city. We are not Portland. We don't have the same constraints as Portland, perhaps, but we have actually many of the same processes and requirements. Just as a simple example, when we construct a public project, one that we're constructing for our own, we send out notice to the utilities probably typically a year to 2 years in advance when we have a preliminary design. We ask them to come in and give us comments and tell us, is there something about this that doesn't work? What do you see as the issues? Later, when we get maybe 18 months from design, from construction, when we've got what we call a final, a preliminary design, a 60% design. We send it out again to the utilities with all the plans, all the maps. Please give us your comments so that we can make sure that we address any issues. Third time, when we have completed design, when we have 90% or 100% design, we'll again send the plans out to the utility, asking them for comments, asking them for suggestions, offering them an opportunity to coordinate. Only after all those three opportunities to review have occurred do we give a utility what in our code is required, a 120-day notice that they actually have to relocate the facilities if it appears from our design that that's required. When we do what we call a public improvement project, which is really a privately engineered public improvement, where a developer is doing the work of engineering and constructing, we require the developer to actually follow pretty much the same process. Before they submit their plans, they have to actually have attached the signature of the relevant utility saying they've seen the plans and had an opportunity to comment on them. We ask them to do that again before the final plans are submitted. And we will not issue a notice to proceed to that developer's engineer until we have documented that they have, in fact, consulted with all of the utilities involved so that if there are relocation issues, they've had an opportunity to address them. We also, in our code, require an annual coordination meeting with all utilities at the time we issue our capital improvement program so that they understand what we're doing, what we've got planned for the next year, and they can begin to prepare for it. Unfortunately, I guess our experience is much like Portland because the utilities regularly just don't involve themselves. And they don't involve themselves until much too late in the process when I'm picking up the phone, calling them, saying, you know, we told you 6 months ago you need to get these facilities out of our way. Our crew is reaching that point, and you're still there. Please help us avoid delay penalties. That's the sort of process that would go on goes on regularly. And yes, there is mutual frustration, I think, between the utilities and the city when it comes to discovering facilities that we didn't know about or discovering that relocation needs to occur that we didn't anticipate. But candidly, there is one major reason for that, and that is the fact that the utilities are routinely unwilling to share with us the maps of their facilities. They'll cite competitive reasons, they'll cite homeland security reasons, but we often don't have good, accurate locations of where their facilities are. If we had those in advance, we could certainly try to plan around them because I don't think there is a single public works official in this state that would not like to try to avoid every conflict with a utility they can. It does nothing but add cost, add inconvenience, and add time to construction of a project. Examples of concerns we have, particularly with the dash fours, and probably Mr. Chandler will be surprised to hear me agreeing with him. He and I often are on different sides of the issue, but he's quite correct in saying that it is not appropriate in many cases to ask development to pay the cost of these relocations. Senator Verger, your question, I think, does have a very simple answer. If a project is involving the public right-of-way, is designed for the general convenience of the traveling public, it is a public improvement, and the utility should be required to relocate. They are locating their facilities in the public's property, in the right-of-way that the public owns for the purpose of travel, purpose of moving goods. They get an enormous benefit from having their facilities in our public rights of way. And I think goes with it an obligation when that right of way is needed for its primary purpose, they need to move. However, the good example of any private subdivision development, interior streets in the subdivision are all private development. If there are utilities in the way of those private, those streets, they need to move. And probably the developer needs to pay for the cost of it. But when it's the public street, when it's designed to serve all of the public, then it's appropriate that the public not pay. Now, Senator, Chair Metzger, the testimony by Mr. Chandler suggested that it's perhaps appropriate for the developer to pay when they can get SDC credits. I'd like to point out that those SDC credits end up reducing the amount of systems development charges that are collected from development for the purpose of providing the very improvements. So, in a sense, even though the developer pays, when they get a systems development credit, system development charge credit, the public ends up paying. One thing I'd like to address specifically is the Dash 2 amendments, because I think Mr. Dorenzo has hit on a very important point. He's right. Competitive local exchange carriers would not be covered by the bill in the Dash 4. Unfortunately, that's sort of the tip of the iceberg, because neither would cable companies, neither would inter-exchange carriers, these long-haul carriers that don't provide telecommunication service in the state but do have facilities in our right-of-way. Neither would electric co-ops or telephone co-ops, perhaps. Very possible people's utility districts would not be covered. Municipal utilities, of course, would not be covered. And even private entities. We have a very large regional hospital that was just built in Springfield. One of their facilities is a 36-inch tube, a pneumatic tube that carries specimens from the hospital to the laboratory. That goes right underneath one of our streets. We intentionally allowed it there. We intentionally got an agreement with them that if we need to change that street for to widen it or do other changes, they will have to relocate. We were also very careful to work with them to make sure that where they placed the street, it would, or their pipe, it would be very unlikely that we ever would require relocation. But Mr. DeLorenzo is right. There are parts left out of this bill, and actually there are many more than he has described. With that, I think I pretty much summarized some of the major issues of the Dash 4s and the Dash 2s. I would just like to take any of your questions if you have them.
Thank you very much. We'll go to our other guest and we'll see.
Chairman Metzger, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for allowing us this opportunity to be before you to speak on these issues. My name is Michael Nitsky. I'm the city manager for the city of Nehalem, and I'm here to support anything that encourages cooperation, mutual cooperation between public bodies and utilities of all sorts, something that sometimes is lacking. But I think there are issues with the Dash 4 amendments that are unintended consequences that need to be addressed up front and looked at very carefully. Just from a general standpoint, I think there needs to be clarity between what is considered relocation and what would be considered an extension of a utility service. When new development comes in, I don't consider it. I mean, new development that we've had in Nehalem has been extension of services to provide that development. That developer pays for those services through their initial hookup costs, whatever fees that go on. Shifting those costs to others along the same street or to the public body itself, to me, is subsidizing the private enterprise of a utility and possibly even of a developer. Versus relocation, whereas through a public improvement project, a street widening, installation of a water line, something of those lines, it's something that if a utility has been located in a spot that from a a street widening project is probably a best example, that we have areas of our town that our right-of-way widths are 60 foot, but we might actually have only 20 foot of asphalt. We want to, of course, improve the transportation, make it safer for all of our folks. So if we go to widen, we're going to have power poles that are going to be in the middle of travel lanes. Those should be considered as relocation activities, and thus done so at the expense of the utility who initially located them in those areas that were not on the edge of the right-of-way. A couple of years ago, the city of Nehalem and the Tillamook People's Utility District negotiated a new agreement, and one of the major issues that came up was utility relocations. Their big concern was that they did not want to have to assume the full cost of a relocation that would be considered a whim, that the city wanted to beautify the downtown, so we wanted all the overhead power lines to be removed and undergrounded at that full expense. We agreed with it, that would not be reasonable. So in our franchise agreement, what we established was that the city may cause the district to relocate any facility within the city rights-of-way to the same or another city rights-of-way whenever the relocation is necessary as part of a city-related infrastructure project. Infrastructure projects are defined as widening or otherwise modifying or constructing streets, installing or modifying sidewalks, installing or relocating water lines, fire hydrants, valves, blow-off storm drains, or sewers. The expense of relocating such facilities will be paid solely by the district. We also have time requirements when it comes time to us notifying the district of a project and them responding back to us, all within an idea of mutual cooperation. We don't want to cause them undue hardship, and we're hoping that they don't cause us undue hardship. I think the Dash 4 amendments have very good intent on the surface, but there are just some specifics that need to be looked at. For example, Section 2, Subsection 6 is too vague in my mind because it does not assign what customer classes would be subject to the relocation costs. And to me, there's also a question about ORS 757.310 in relation to prohibitions against charging different rates to different to the same customer classes. Subsection 7 to me is also very troublesome of the Dash 4 amendments because it bases the capital improvements plans on SDCs, specifically 223.309, I believe. The city of Nehalem only has one system development charge, that being water. We do not have streets, parks, or anything else that's currently allowed under law. Under this provision, the only thing that the city would not be liable for these relocation costs would be for an infrastructure project relating to water. If we're widening a street by the Dash 4 amendments, we would be liable for all those relocation costs, or worse, our citizens would be liable for them. Finally, in their subsection 2, subsection 8, as previously discussed, relocation costs are considered an operational cost and are accounted for in normal rate structure. My concern is that if the utilities are allowed to be able to put a separate line item on a customer's bill, there's two issues. Number one is the possibility of double charging for the same expense. But number two is that that line item could be misrepresented as a government tax. It was an issue that came up some years ago when some of the utilities started putting the franchise fees as a line on the tax. We didn't like it, but we accepted it because that's in a sense of what it was, at least what the city of Nehalem considered it to be. This, to me, is something else, and it just raises some concerns. The city of Nehalem is in full support of the Dash 3 amendments because it does encourage cooperation between the public utilities and the cities and ensures that if cities do not have or counties have franchise or service agreements with their different utilities that have provisions for location costs or just the sense of cooperation, that by statute it would be there just to try to encourage. And again, I apologize for my rambling. I would take any questions.
Just fine, Ms. Niskey. Thank you. Questions for any of the three panelists? Well, it seems like it's clear to me that when we've heard from the utilities, we've heard from the developers, and we've heard from cities and counties that there seems to be a general agreement that this is an important issue, that we need to coordinate better. We need to encourage participation better. There's been some of that. And there's where we still seem to have some issues is regarding the, who's going to foot the bill and how that's going to be allocated. And I know this still is a work in progress. And Ms. Lang is in the back room, has heard all the comments that have been presented here today, so I'm sure she has made copious notes in working forward. What I will say is I think this issue is very, very important, too. And we're tentatively going to schedule this for the 22nd or 23rd for a work session to move this bill this month. And the purpose of that is to give you a couple more weeks to try to continue to narrow the issues that have been brought here that are important, and so that we can kind of move this process forward. So, and I know you've been all working very, very hard on this through your representatives on it, and we got a couple weeks left. So I would just encourage you to work diligently on those key areas of disagreement or some of the things that need to be included in the bill that were brought up in the committee today. And we'll take a look at those products. And again, with the Public Utility Commission and Ms. Lang, if you would ensure that the City of Portland has an opportunity to participate with that, I would appreciate it. Yes, Ms. Folk.
We would like that as well.
Well, you already do. I think your you're pretty actively involved. Well,
with the 2.9 section.
Okay.
With the
I think it's going to be open to anyone who would like to weigh in, and you can communicate with the representative from the OPUC to ensure that that happens.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll be hearing this bill again in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 269. We'll do a little chair moving around here. Welcome Aaron to the dais. We'll send Mr. Stembridge into obscurity.
What's he saying?
Temporarily.
Yeah.
And see how he performs. Let's open a public. I'm going to open a public hearing on both Senate Bill 128 and Senate Bill 536. And we'll start with, because they're very related. Let's have Aaron give us a summary of both bills as they are before us today.
Senate Bill 128 is relating to documents issued by Oregon Department of Transportation. We do have a dash one amendment. It replaces the measure, and what it does is specifies validity period for limited term driver's permits. It changes DMV renewal notification requirements, and it authorizes issuance of fictitious driver's license to law enforcement personnel. Now we have Senate Bill 536, which prohibits an Oregon agency from expending funds to implement the Federal Real ID Act of 2005 unless sufficient federal funds are allocated to cover the estimated costs.
Thank you for the overview. And members, we've had these issues the last couple of years, and I know we've talked about them. And I think this gets us a little closer on some important issues and also reasserts the legislature's current intent on some of the issues that a year ago we also decided were not quite appropriate. So that's why they're related, and we're going to ask, we have two people signed up on the two bills, and they're the same. So let's ask Andrea Meyer from the ACLU and Tom McClellan, representing the Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles, to come forward, and we'll begin by, I'll have you both address the Senate Bill 128, and then we'll talk about 536, and we'll move from there. Mr. McClellan.
I'll start. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 128, as amended, cleans up some driver license provisions. The amendment leaves three largely housekeeping provisions from the original bill. It clarifies the issuance of limited-term driver permits, the timelines for mailing expiration notices to those people who have those limited-term cards, and clarifies the issuance of fictitious driver license and identification cards to law enforcement officials doing undercover type work. I do have some background information here as well. On the limited-term driver permits legislation, which you passed in 2008, requires DMV to issue limited-term driver licenses, driver permits, and ID cards, and we are working on that provision. It takes effect January 1 of 2010. Those cards are issued to people who are legally present in this country temporarily, so less than permanent. So people will end up with a card that's only valid for the time that they are here in this country legally. Current law makes no exception, though, for the driver permits that have a shorter expiration. And I've got some examples here. An instruction permit valid for 24 months, a motorcycle instruction permit valid for 1 year. Other types of driver permits, like student and emergency permits, have varying lengths of time. We don't believe it was the intent that there'd be a different duration for a driver permit for those people who are only qualify for a limited term card. So we just want to clarify that. The second item deals with expiration notices. We are required to notify people that their driver license or their ID card is about to expire. We mail those notices about 60 days prior to the expiration date. Because the limited term cards described above can be issued for a shorter period of time, it's possible the person's limited term card could expire before the renewal notice is even mailed out. So we're just asking for authority to mail those renewal notices if the limited term card is valid for a period of less than 1 year. Practically speaking, it'll probably be 60 days or less. We will not mail a renewal notice to people. And the last item deals with what we've called fictitious licenses and identification cards. We've been doing this since 1977 under general authority, advice from the Attorney General's office. In looking at the rules for the Federal Real ID Act, we realized that we didn't have specific language in statute to allow us to do that, so we included that in Senate Bill 128. We're asking that we have that specific language put into statute so that we can continue to do that. So in summary, there's three items in the Dash 1 amendment. First is to limit the expiration date of a limited-term driver permit to no longer than the period of time that a driver permit of the same type is issued, to refrain from mailing renewal note reminders to persons who receive a limited-term driver license, driver permit, or ID card for less than 1 year, and to continue issuing those fictitious driver licenses and ID cards that law enforcement officials use for their undercover purposes.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. As you may recall, during the informational hearing a few months ago, ACLU testified regarding these issues and raised significant concerns about Senate Bill 128 as originally put forward to this committee. It took significant steps towards complying with Real ID. We have now met a number of times with DMV, and the proposal Dash 1 amendments brought to you today, as far as we are concerned, remove all of the Real ID implementing language that raised significant concerns to us, and we are comfortable with the Dash 1s and would be formally neutral on it as when it comes to fictitious driver's licenses for law enforcement. ACLU just simply doesn't have a position on that. And the remainder, as we read and understand and work with DMV, do some cleanup and tightening based on Senate Bill 1080, which you've already enacted into law in February. Oh, wait. So with that, we would be happy to see these amendments adopted into Senate Bill 128.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for either of these folks on Senate Bill 128?
Thank you. Mr. McClellan, the question I have, it relates to dollars. Remind the committee about any federal funds that the department has received to implement the Real ID, and if we pass basically either one of these bills, the requirement to move forward on Real ID is negated, and so what would occur with those, what would happen with those dollars? Would those be refunded to the federal government, or could you comment on that?
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we have received, last year we received about $1.2 million from the federal government, and just this week we were notified that there's another $834,000 that's available for the state of Oregon for driver license improvements. And there's a wide range of things that those dollars can be used for. What we have done in applying for those dollars is tied them to Senate Bill 1080, to those provisions that you adopted around legal presence, verification of Social Security numbers and immigration documents, going to full legal name, a limited-term card, all those types of things that you've already approved. They're also Real ID-type provisions, so we're able to use the federal funds to implement those changes. It's our plan to continue to do those same types of things up to the limits of what you've approved up to now. There are certain things that have been taken out of this bill that we would not do. Because we don't have your authority to do that, we wouldn't use the federal funds. So anything left over, if there was extra, you're right, that would go back to the federal government.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, if I may add, because I want to get this on the record to be clear about both of these proposals before you, it is not our intention, we do not believe when we talk about Senate Bill 536, that it will in any way affect current Oregon law, and this, which was enacted through Senate Bill 1080, but is currently then enacted through statutes, and any work or funds that DMV is receiving to comply with current Oregon law. So we do not believe the funds that they are currently using to that they've received from the federal government should or would be affected under either of these proposals that you passed forward today. If that makes it clear.
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, another point I should make is the federal funds do not obligate a state to comply with the federal, fully comply, or even materially comply with the Real ID Act. There are dollars available to states to improve their issuance processes, their systems, those types of things, around some pretty broad kind of general parameters. But it doesn't obligate the state to fully comply.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions? One thing this is a minor point I just brought up in the committee, and when we first heard this bill, so I just want to ask it for the purposes of the record. A concern of mine that, again, was a small one, but just one, is was on the fictitious IDs. Just because it's for the law enforcement, a legitimate issue, et cetera. But I had asked the question about do we ever get them back, and how long do we know? And in your language of this bill, you're going to set, you can by rule set the criteria for making a request under this section, and that would give you the authority to have a discussion about when they may have to come back and say, do you still need this? Are they still employed? Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Metzger. Every year we do an audit. Annually we contact each of the law enforcement agencies that have active fictitious licenses just to ensure they're still using them. About 10% at the end of 8 years come back to us and they're not renewed. But we also check in with them at the end of each year just to make sure that they're still being used for the purposes they were intended. So we have an audit process as well as an application process they have to go through to prove their eligibility.
Thank you. Okay, now let's, we're open on both bills, so I would like to move our discussion to Senate Bill 536, and again, I'll start with the department. I'll start with you, Andrea. Yes, I'm sorry.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, again, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, pleased to testify today in support of Senate Bill 536, and I want to thank the chair as the chief sponsor and all of you for hopefully moving forward on this bill. It's an important issue, and I've provided you written testimony simply so that there is material in the record. It's quite similar to what I provided during the informational hearing. Senate Bill 536 joins, if it is passed, we would join 11 other states that have said we are not moving forward to comply with Real ID, and there are an additional 10 other states that have passed resolutions urging Congress to repeal. This is an important movement, we believe, to send a strong message to Congress, which has, as you know, not funded Real ID and has not, and through the federal government, has significantly delayed implementation. The issues left in Real ID in Oregon and across the country are privacy issues, specifically, and one of the significant concerns for us, it was actually contained in Senate Bill 128 as originally done, is the electronic scanning and storing of all our identity documents that we currently provide to DMV, which currently authenticates and verifies these documents, but does not scan and store them and share them in a 50-state shared database accessible all across this country, which raises significant identity theft questions. There's also other verification processes that are required under Real ID that don't exist in terms of verifying documents throughout databases, and so we are pleased that Oregon would join the efforts to say no to this infringement and risk to identity theft and unfunded mandate and urge the passage of Senate Bill 536. I've already indicated on the record our position regarding its implications on the actions that DMV is currently doing. And again, we do not see it having any implication on the funding or action of DMV currently under Oregon law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Now, Mr. McClellan,
Mr. Chair,
for the department.
Members of the committee, you have my written testimony, talks about the bill. I've talked about these timelines for compliance, and the penalty for non-compliance is that the cards won't be accepted for purposes of federal identification. There's no federal financial penalty for non-compliance. It's just that our cards would not be accepted at a certain point in time. So I've told you that before. You understand the implications of that. Another point that I just want to make is that the department issues secure driver license and ID cards today. We protect personal information. We utilize tools and techniques to prevent and detect fraud. We do those things today. Improvements are made routinely. I think you would expect that of any state government agency to continue to improve upon what it does. Some changes may move Oregon closer toward compliance with the Real ID Act, with the federal law, even if that's a secondary consideration. We would not want this bill to be interpreted, this law to be interpreted as precluding us from making improvements that may secondarily make Oregon closer to being compliant with the federal law. It's not a completely evil and terrible law. There are some actually good things in there that even my partner at the table would probably support. But still, the agency should be able to continue to move ahead with some of those things without being accused or pointed to that we're trying to comply with the Real ID Act. So that's just maybe a minor point, but I just don't want to get that on the record, that some things we may do in the future may move us closer toward compliance, but maybe that's not the intent, to achieve that star on our forehead or a certificate of some kind. Okay? The bill has some language in it that is somewhat vague. It has doesn't look like sufficient, unreasonable, and we would interpret that as you giving us the authority, the discretion, to make those types of determinations in the future as far as whether something is sufficient or something is unreasonable. Those are judgment-type words. So it's not spelled out in the bill. I think that we appreciate that discretion that you have provided here, that a decision has to be made and some kind of judgment call has to be provided there. On the back page of my presentation, just pointing out, kind of reiterating what Andrea pointed out, is that we have done some things that could be attributed to real ID compliance, and we have some things in progress as well through Senate Bill 1080 from February of 08 that we would want to continue to finish out to completely implement. And we would not think that this bill, the intent of this bill is not to stop that work, not to prescribe something different than what's currently in state law and what the legislative intent is. So with that, I'll stop.
Thank you, Mr. Klon. Just a few things, and I appreciate your work on that. And, of course, we've had many discussions on this for now, you know, a year and a half or so. And the real important issue here, or one of the most important issues, is not questioning the security of the DMV in terms of the great steps that have been taken over the last number of years. You know, it's the concern about as we go out and entrust 50 other states or jurisdictions and the federal government with information that may be secure when we have it, but may not be so secure if it goes. And I realize that the timelines are always an issue, but they've been a moving target and continue to be a moving target. And one thing I think is just very, very important is that we want to make sure the data is secure. We just don't want to trust that Mississippi and Alabama and Iowa have the same safeguards that you are working so diligently with the great employees at DMV here. And also, I think it's important, as with other states, sending a message to the federal government that, you know, this is a partnership, and we need to be part of that discussion as well as the funding issues. The other good thing, as with all legislation, when you mentioned about not being precluded from something that may be good that we want to do as a citizens, and, you know, we always have that word notwithstanding, and, you know, every year we can come back, and if there's a particular element that we want to put in of something, we can add that element as justified to the legislature to continue to move forward. And as opposed to the other question about things that you're currently doing, this bill has an effective date of January 1, 2010, all the things that we're currently involved in, whatever, you know, are not impacted by that. As Ms. Meyer said, things that are already Oregon law that we've already authorized to do. So I just want to put those on the record. And I do appreciate your cooperation in working on this issue and helping define it and also bringing the issues, you know, forward. Questions for either Ms. Meyer or Mr. McClellan? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Mr. McClellan, the question I guess I would have is we're opening public hearing on both these bills, so if we pass Senate Bill 128, that basically outlines the direction for the department to go, that clearly does not lead us to full compliance with Real ID. If we pass that bill, what benefit do you see us obtaining or having by passing the other bill that seems to be just reiterates the fact that we're passing 128, not allowing you to go forward anyway? My sense is that we don't need 5 to pass 536 because, in effect, by passing the amendments to 128, we're getting to the same point. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think that the net effect, Oregon will not comply with Senate Bill 128. I think that's a given. And any effect that might have. You're right. The federal government, through its laws and its regulations, could easily change again, could grandfather states, could extend timelines, those types of things. As it stands right now, effective January 1st of next year, our cards may not be accepted for federal purposes. That's a given, whether you pass both together or just the amendment to 128. That's a net effect. What you get with Senate Bill 536 are some additional safeguards, some greater direction to our agency of what we can and can't do. There's a report on the estimated cost to fully comply with the Real ID Act. We do those estimates periodically because it is a moving target. The goalpost keeps moving on us. We make progress over time, so we continue to do new estimates on that. But this bill does require a public report on what the estimated cost would be to fully comply. We wouldn't necessarily make that a public report. We'll do that type of analysis anyway. So I think I agree with you in saying that if you pass the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 128, you still get the net effect of Oregon is not going to comply with the Federal Real ID Act as currently stated.
Ms. Starr, you wanted to comment?
Briefly, Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, I would say I agree. There's additional safeguards put in. I think there are ways that a state can move forward on further implementation of Real ID without statutory authority, or there may be some question about whether it needs statutory authority. You've seen some things in Senate Bill 128 that clearly do need statutory authority, but I think this sends clear guidance and policy direction to the state and the agencies within as to what the expectation is with things that might not require statutory implementation but move us forward under Real ID unnecessarily. So I would urge passage of both and do think it has significant effect in Oregon as well as further effect in Oregon joining the efforts and speaking loudly to Congress and around this country that this needs to be fixed. So we would hope it passed, though. Thank you.
Thank you. Another question? Well, and as I mentioned, as we've experienced in this committee, this is an ongoing evolutionary issue that I think, for at least for the next few years, is going to continue to come back to us, and we'll be evaluating the circumstances as it exists on that given day. So thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 128, 536. It would be my desire to move both these bills to the floor. I am going to open a work session on Senate Bill 128. And we have a Dash 1 amendment on that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 128.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 128. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 128 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 128 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 128. Open a work session on Senate Bill 536. Are you okay with this bill, Senator Starr? Or?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move Senate Bill 536 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 536 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr?
You know, this is a states' rights issue. I am concerned about the federal government not blinking, and that our citizens are going to potentially be greatly inconvenienced, potentially. You know, this is a gamble to a certain extent that we as policymakers are making, and there's a number of other states that are making a similar gamble, expecting that the federal government will come back to the bargaining table, negotiating table on this issue. If they do not, believe you me that we will all hear it from our constituents. You know, that's a risk that we, I think, take as we move a bill like this and we move the previous bill. You know, if you got a passport, you're not going to be in any trouble traveling on airplanes. But if you've got a non-compliant driver's license and the federal government does not back down on their requirement, and you look at the war on terror, and you look at issues surrounding that, I'm not convinced that the Congress will change the Real ID. And so I just want to put that on the record. I think that I'd love for the federal government to step at the plate and help to fund this particular unfunded mandate. As you know, Mr. Chair, we are faced with unfunded mandates in virtually every area that we legislate in this building. So I just want to put that on record.
Appreciate that. Any other comments? And I'll just add one more. I mean, Senator Starr, we talked about this before in the previous years on this. Those are issues. That's what the federal government has said. They keep moving those timelines. And my own intuition is if the federal government was to issue a, you know, well, we're going to do it and this is the date type thing. I have a suspicion that they would give us plenty of notice that the goal line hasn't moved, and I guess we would have to readjust it at that time. But for now, I think this is a good policy. Is there any objection to the motion to move Senate Bill 536 to the floor as due pass? Not so ordered. And is it? I guess I'll just carry both bills. Okay. Okay. Let's see. What day is this? Thursday. We are adjourned.